So in the Gospel of Mark, what Mark has been wanting to do is to show us who Jesus is. And his basic answer to that question is that Jesus is God's chosen king, which means as a king, he has authority. And so over these first few chapters, he's been showing us all the different things that Jesus has authority over, that he's greater than, basically, that he's more powerful than, so that we'll see him for who he really is. And today what we're going to see is that Jesus has authority over the forces of nature, that he's more powerful even than crazy storms, more powerful than the wind and the waves. And the reason that comes up is because a big storm hits a boat that Jesus is in with his disciples. And when Jesus' disciples see the wind and the waves crashing into their boat, they do what we always do when we see a threat. They make an interpretation of that threat. We as humans are inevitably interpreting everything we see around us. And sometimes we make good and wise interpretations of that, but often we make false interpretations of it. And when we see a threat that is powerful and that we can't control, our most common interpretation is fear. Now, fear is not necessarily bad in every context, right? Like, fear can motivate you to action. Like, if a speeding car is coming at you, you should be afraid and you should get out of the way. But it's all too easy for fear to become a controlling factor in your life. And what we're going to see in this passage is three keys to not being controlled by fear, to not being consumed by the possibility of threats out in the world. What you need to not be controlled by fear is you need someone to be with you, you need someone to be for you, and you need that someone to be powerful, to be more powerful than the threats that you're facing. By the end of the passage we're going to look at today, Jesus's disciples experience that Jesus is actually all three of those things for them. And therefore, at the end, they end up fearing Jesus more than they fear the waves and the wind. But it's a good kind of fear, because by the end, they're so fearing Jesus that they're no longer fearing the wind and the waves. So fear Jesus more than anything else, because Jesus is with you, Jesus is for you, and Jesus is powerful. So let's go ahead and look at our passage to see each of those three things about Jesus. We're in Mark chapter 4. The chapter is the big numbers, the verses are the small ones. Starting in verse 35, I'm going to read out loud verses 35 through the end of the chapter. On that day, when evening had come, he, speaking of Jesus, said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So the first thing we're going to notice in this story is that Jesus is with you. So Mark begins by giving us a brief introduction to the setting that we're seeing. But sometimes when you're reading this beginning of stories like this, it's easy to gloss over some potentially significant details. So it gets to be night. Jesus has been teaching from a boat to a large crowd. And he says, "Let's go away. Let's go to the other side of the sea." So the disciples begin to go. And in verse 36, Mark points out that leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And then he tells us this great windstorm and these waves start crashing into their boat. So it's getting a little dicey out there, and the waves are crashing in. But then in verse 38, Mark goes right back to his big question, kind of, where is Jesus when all of this is going on? And he emphasizes that Jesus was in the stern. Jesus is there in the boat. So maybe one of the most obvious things we can see about this story is that Jesus is there. He's with them in the boat. The waves are very chaotic, right? There's this picture of disorder. Nothing's going right. Everything's going wrong. But there's one person and one part of the story that's calm while all that is happening. The waves are crashing in, but Jesus is in the stern. And it says that he was asleep. Now, how could he be sleeping when all this stuff is happening? And the question we're going to look at, and the question you've probably wondered at some point, is how can Jesus be calm when there's so many threats in my life? How can Jesus stand back and let all these things happen to me? And there's kind of three reasons that someone could be calm while you're facing a threat. One is they're not there. Another is they don't care. And another is they may know something that you don't know. So for example, if someone's not there, it's easy for them to be calm when you're facing a threat. I have a confession to make. I'm not particularly proud of this, but it's true. So apparently a week or two ago, North Korea launched a test rocket that is apparently going to enable them to take another step forward towards having a nuclear warhead that could potentially reach the United States. But when I heard this report, I heard them say it could reach the west coast of the United States. And I have to be honest, the first thought that came into my head was, man, I'm glad I live on the East Coast. It was easy for me to not panic about that because I'm not there. I'm not facing the same threat they're facing on the West Coast. And when you're facing trials, when you see something powerful that you can't control that's threatening you, one of the most tempting lies to believe is that Jesus is not here. He's not facing the same things I'm facing. He doesn't understand what I'm going through. The false interpretation, remember we said we're always interpreting the facts. The false interpretation we make is that the only things present right now are those threats and me. And the threats are more powerful than I am. So I have to freak out. That's all that's here. We assume the presence of chaos, the presence of the waves, the presence of a threat means the absence of Jesus. Because how could he be there and not be doing anything? But what this passage shows us is that it's actually possible for Jesus to be right there and to be asleep in the stern while the waves are coming. Jesus isn't on the East Coast while his disciples are dealing with the waves on the West Coast. He's in the boat with them. Jesus is facing the exact same threats they are. The waves hitting their boat are the waves hitting Jesus' boat as well. He's with you when you suffer. But the ultimate threat that Jesus would face with his disciples wasn't the danger of a storm. The ultimate threat, the fear behind every other fear, is the fear of death. That's the thing they're afraid of here. They're not afraid of waves. They're afraid of perishing. And yet what's amazing about Jesus is that that is a threat that he would not only face the potential of with his disciples, it's a threat he would face the reality of when he died on the cross. The cross is the ultimate, I am with you. Jesus is saying, I am with humanity to the point even of death, that even though he is truly God, he comes to earth in boats that are being hit by waves, and he dies on a cross. So whatever you fear, whatever threat you're facing, Jesus is with you in it. Do you fear starvation? Jesus fasted for 40 days in the wilderness, eating nothing. Do you fear homelessness, being lost? Jesus said, the Son of Man, referring to himself, has no place to lay his head. Do you fear being unattractive? In the Bible, Jesus is described as having no beauty that we should desire him or no form that we should look at him. Do you fear evil or crime being committed against you? Jesus was the ultimate victim of unjust, evil, and false charges. Do you fear rejection? Jesus was rejected by the people who were closest to him, by his own disciples and his family. Do you fear pain? Jesus was beaten and flogged and tortured. Do you fear loneliness? Not only was Jesus abandoned by those close to him, he was so abandoned that on the cross he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Forsaken even by his own heavenly Father who he had done nothing wrong against. Do you fear death? Jesus has died for you and with you. He's been through every threat that you're afraid of. He has experienced it himself, and he is with you. Who is a God like that? I mean, it's easy to stand back in heaven and to say, don't be afraid, you know, it'll all be all right. It's easy to sit on the East Coast and say, it'll all be okay. But Jesus gets into the boat. Jesus dies on the cross. He experiences it himself. So it's not just cheap talk when he tells you not to be afraid. So what do you do with that? Well, maybe it's, again, one of those things that's obvious in the passage, but because Jesus was with them, they could run to him. They could go to him. They could talk to him when the waves hit their boat because he was there. And they offer to him what by anyone's account is a pretty crappy prayer, right? Like it's, hey, don't you care about us? What's wrong with you, you know? But what's amazing is Jesus responds to that prayer. What's amazing is they went and woke him up. And how often do we not even wake him up? How often do we think he's not with us? The only thing here is the waves and us. The prayer, very imperfect, not a model. If you want to learn how to pray, don't look at this prayer, okay? But you learn something very important about prayer from this. The priority in prayer isn't that you say the right words. And the priority in following Jesus isn't that you do it everything right. The priority is that you ask the right person. They went to the right person. They went to Jesus. And because they went to Jesus with their junk, with their imperfect understanding of him, we're going to see later they were wrong. They didn't get who he was. They didn't get his power, but they went to him. And Jesus responds to that kind of prayer. Because he's the one who is powerful, not us. And it doesn't depend on the power of our faith. It depends on the one you're believing in, the one that you're trusting in. So you can go to him, even imperfectly. I've noticed, you know, recently when I'm feeling afraid, when I'm feeling anxious, usually what I want to do with that is analyze it a lot. Okay, what am I afraid of? You know, what's the truth that I need to believe? Is it this? Well, maybe I should be kind of afraid of that. You know, that is a real threat. But, you know, on the other hand, it could be inordinate. It could be excessive. And, you know, what do you think? And there's a lot of conversation happening inside my head and very little conversation happening with Jesus. So stop analyzing your fears and just go to Jesus with them. Tell him about them. Ask him whatever words come out to help you. And that's not to say there's not room to grow in that, you know, and you could do better than what the disciples did, but it's just to say, don't make that the priority. Don't make that the thing that's preventing you from coming to Jesus. You can just run to him now because he's with you. He's been through exactly what you're going through, and he can help you now in your time of need. But again, we assume if he were really here, I wouldn't be going through this trial. And that's why it's important not only to know that Jesus is with you, but to see that Jesus is for you as well. And that's the thing that the disciples question first, we see in verse 38. They come to him, and what's the question they ask him? It's, teacher, don't you care? Do you not care that we are perishing? That we are facing this threat? And the assumption behind that, the false interpretation that we see there, is that if Jesus were really with me, I wouldn't be facing this trial. There's no way he'd let me go through that and just be afraid in the boat. It's the second reason that we think someone might be calm. It's that they're not there. No, Jesus is there. He's present. But maybe he just doesn't care. And that's the question the disciples ask him. And that's the easy thing to think when you're facing a trial, when something difficult comes into your life. You may think God's here, he's present, but he must be indifferent to the things that I'm facing. There's kind of an intellectual version of this objection. Bertrand Russell, who was an atheist in the 1900s, says, if there's evil in the world, God must not exist. Because if God existed and he were powerful but didn't stop it, he must not be good. But if God were good and he didn't stop it, he must not be powerful. The assumption behind that is God could have no good reason to allow the trials and the difficulties that we experience in life to be the case. And what Jesus is showing us here is that that's not true, that he can actually be present, and he does actually care, and yet he still lets the waves hit the boat. And in fact, the way he responds to this is a little jarring, right? Like, so the disciples ask him, do you not care that we are perishing? And then what he does is he starts a rebuke. Now, who would you expect Jesus to rebuke after getting that question? You expect him to rebuke the disciples, to say, what's wrong with you guys? And he gets to them, right? He does address them. But look at the first thing that Jesus rebukes. The first thing he does is he rebukes the wind. And he speaks to the sea, and he tells them, peace, be still. The first thing Jesus does is he fights on behalf of his disciples, not against them. He shows them, I'm for you. It's as if he's saying to them, even in the midst of this crappy prayer, I'm for you. Even when your faith is weak, I fight on your behalf. Because you have to see that Jesus is fighting for you. You have to see that he's for you before you can receive his correction. If every time Jesus rebukes you, you think Jesus is against me, he doesn't want me, he's condemning me, it'll crush you. You'll run from it. But if you've just seen Jesus calm the wind and the waves on your behalf, if you know that he fights for you and not against you, you can hear the correction that he brings to his disciples then. He proves it that he's for them because he fights for them instead of fighting against them. But then he does get to them, right? He responds to them. And as I said, it comes off kind of like a jerk response, you know, like, well, why do you not believe? Have you no faith? You know, he says, why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? And we can kind of sympathize with the disciples. We're like, hey, come on. Like, they were in a tight spot here. They had waves crashing into their boat. They had no idea what to do. And their leader was sleeping. And so, you know, okay, it makes sense that they would just run to him. And yet he kind of pushes back. He kind of, you know, corrects them in that way. And it rubbed me wrong. But I heard a pastor explain this once in a way that was really helpful that I want to relay to you guys. I'm not a parent, but he said that, you know, that this pastor was a parent. And what he basically said is that if you are a parent, there will come a time in your life, sometime when your kids are teenagers, where you'll withhold something from them that they think is really important. But you know, for their good, hey, you just can't do this. I'm not going to let it fly. And they'll accuse you, and they'll say, you don't really love me. How dare you? Think about what you're going to want to say to them in that moment. Some of you are parents, and some of you have small kids. And think about the days that you spent where your whole schedule revolved around your kids. Think about the money that you've given up and invested into them. Think about the time. Think about the sleepless nights. Think about the weekends where you couldn't go out because you couldn't get a babysitter on time or you couldn't afford to do it again. Think about all you sacrificed. What are you going to want to say to your kids in that moment? You're going to say, how can you say that? Like, if only you knew how much I've sacrificed in order to love you, you couldn't possibly say that. Because you know that it's ridiculous to base someone's love for you off of this little circumstance. You know they should be basing it off of what it's cost you to love them. And that's what Jesus is saying here. But it didn't just cost Jesus his time, energy, and money to love his disciples. It was going to cost him his life to love his disciples. See, waters and these chaotic storm that we're seeing here, that shows up all throughout the Bible. And throughout the Bible, these chaotic waters are usually a sign of God's judgment. So whenever God wants to judge the world in the story of Noah early in the Bible, he brings a flood on the world. He brings chaotic waters to judge the evil of the world. Whenever God's rescuing his people Israel from Egypt, he brings chaotic waters on their enemies, in judgment on their enemies. And here are Jesus' disciples questioning his goodness and his love for them. And they deserve for these chaotic waters to fall on them. And so do we. And yet Jesus is able to look at the waters and calm them because he knows that he's going to take the waters of God's judgment on their behalf. He knows the very reason he has come to earth, the very reason he's here when this story is happening, the reason he's in the boat with them is because he's come to die for them, because he's come to lay down his life for them. That's what it's going to cost Jesus to love his disciples. And they come and say, don't you care about us? Don't you care that we are perishing? And you can almost imagine Jesus saying in response, do you not care that I'm perishing? I'm perishing for you. And we question his love for us. If you're interpreting God's favor for you out of your circumstances, that is a wrong interpretation. Interpret God's love for you based on what he gave up to love you. Romans 8:32, it says, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? The logic is, if he didn't spare his son, then you can know he loves you. You can know today that Jesus is for you because he gave his own life for you. Your circumstances will change, right? There will be some days where life feels easier, where things are better, where things are happy. There will be some days where it's not, where the waves are hitting the boat, the trials are coming, things are scary. If you base God's favor and God's love for you off of which day it is, That's a really shaky foundation. You're always going to be back and forth. You're never going to know. You're never going to have stability. But if you base God's favor for you off of the cross, that happened 2,000 years ago. No circumstance in your life today can change the fact that Jesus died for you, that he gave his life for you. And so you can know today, whatever trial you're going through, however hard it is to conceptualize that God could actually be good right now, even with the stuff in my life and the threats and the difficulties that are hitting me, you can know that Jesus died in my place. Whatever waves, so to speak, are hitting you right now, you can know the greater storm of God's judgment has already been taken on my behalf. The greatest power that could threaten me has already been suffered for me. And so there's no question, if you are with Jesus, whether Jesus is for you. He's given his life for you. It's definitive proof, despite our changing circumstances. But the last thing you have to see is not just that Jesus is with you and that Jesus is for you, but he has to actually be powerful enough to do something about it. And that's the thing that our passage shows us last. So he rebukes the wind and the sea before he rebukes the disciples. He dies in their place, showing that he's for them. But here's what's amazing. How many of us, if we rebuked wind and sea, I mean, how many of you talk to the wind? Maybe some of you hate this weather and you try talking to it, like, be warm out, you know? Still 8 degrees, and so tough luck. So Jesus talks to wind and sea, and they obey him. He tells them, be still, be quiet. And they actually calm down. So the third reason we saw that you can be calm while others are facing a trial. One is you're not there. Jesus is there. One is you don't care. Jesus proves that he cares. But the third reason is you may know something that the people around you don't know. So, like, let's say I'm facing a physical threat, right? Like, I see something that's scary and I think it's going to threaten my life. But I have a friend with me who's a Navy SEAL. And he sees this threat coming and he's just like, whatever, dude, calm down. Now, I can look at him and be like, don't you care about me? Like, what's wrong with you? Or I can just trust, like, this guy's kind of the expert in close combat, and I'm not. I've never been in a fight in my life. So if he's not afraid, probably because there's nothing to be afraid of. It's probably because he knows what he's talking about. He knows something I don't. He knows I could kill that guy in, like, 5 seconds with a plastic fork, you know? Like, it's nothing to him. And that's what Jesus is saying here. He's saying, you guys are freaking out, but I know something you don't know. I know I can say three words and that whole thing will calm down. I'm way more powerful than the threats that you're facing in your life. So the third false interpretation that we usually make when we're facing trials is that my threats, the thing threatening me, is the most powerful force in the world. It's certainly more powerful than I am, and that's a true interpretation. But the false interpretation is that there's nothing more powerful out there. What Jesus shows us is that he is the one who is more powerful. When the threats come, we freak out, right? It's chaotic. We see them. We see ourselves. That's more powerful than me. Time to freak out. But Jesus isn't freaking out. Do you ever think about that? When stuff goes crazy in your life, you're freaking out. Jesus isn't. He's not taken by surprise because he knows something you don't. He knows he's way more powerful than whatever that thing you're facing is. See, we tend to fear things that are powerful and that we can't control. And what Jesus is showing us here is that he's more powerful than that thing you're afraid of, and you definitely can't control him because he's God. So what results in verse 41? They're filled with great fear. They end up fearing Jesus. They end up saying, if he's the one who's more powerful and the thing I was afraid of, and I can't control him, that's the one I should actually have a great awe towards. In fact, the kind of power that Jesus exercises here throughout the Bible is only ever exercised by God. There's stories throughout Scripture of God when he created the earth that he actually did it by speaking to the waves, by telling them how far they could come and then telling them to stop. In fact, there's a story in the book of Job where Job, you know, asks God all these crazy questions. And God basically comes down and says, hey, you're not God. And one of the proofs that he gives for that is, can you speak to the waves and tell them to stop? And Job's obviously like, okay, good point, you know? But here's Jesus, and what's he doing? Speaking to the waves and telling them to stop, and they obey him. He's showing that he's God. He's showing that he's the only one who's really worthy of your ultimate fear. It's the kind of thing, but it's a unique kind of fear, okay? A lot of fears make you want to run away. I'm scared of this person. I don't want to be around him, so I'm going to go the other direction. But if you know that let's say I see my friend the Navy SEAL beat the mess out of some guy who's, you know, threatening me. I'm going to be kind of afraid of him because I know, wow, he's more powerful than even this guy who was attacking me. But I'm going to want to stick with him because I know being with him is actually the safest place to be. So he's the one who can defeat all my enemies. And Jesus' greatest display of power, again, it wasn't going to be calming this storm. His greatest display of power was going to be calming the storm of God's judgment against us. His greatest power is shown on the cross. The biggest enemy you have, think about it. If the one who's more powerful than anything else is God, the only thing to fear is not fear itself, it's to fear God's judgment. Because that's the only thing that can conquer everything else. And but if Jesus has taken that in your place, if he's received God's judgment for you, he's won the greatest possible victory. He's conquered the only storm that can ultimately kill you, the only storm that can ultimately hurt you. Seeing this, seeing that as Jesus' ultimate power, that's the only way to have the kind of fear God is after. It's the only way to have the kind of fear that makes you want to stay in the boat with Jesus instead of wanting to run away from him. Did you see that? That's the cool thing about the way the disciples fear him. They have this great fear. They say, who then is this? And therefore they think, we better never leave this guy. We want to stay with him. In order to have that kind of fear of Jesus, you have to know him in all three of these ways. You have to know that he's with you, for you, and powerful. Let's just imagine for a moment that he was only two of these. You know, let's say he was only powerful and with you, but he wasn't for you. That would actually be really scary. Because now you've got the Navy SEAL. He's with you, standing right next to you, but he doesn't like you. Okay. Now I'm worried. Now I want to run away. And this is how religious people tend to think of God. They think God's very powerful. God's a judge, and he's everywhere. He sees everything. So you better behave. You better shape up. And you live life with kind of a low-grade anxiety that like, I'm constantly disappointing God, and one of these days he's just going to zap me. And in fact, whenever bad things happen in your life, that's what you tend to read it as. You tend to think, okay, God's finally getting me for all the wrong stuff that I've been doing. Because you don't have a confidence that God is for you, that Jesus is for you. And you have to see Jesus dying on the cross in your place to know God's judgment has been taken. Therefore, no matter what I'm facing, it's not because he's not for me. He's actually for me in Christ. Imagine God was with you and for you, but he wasn't powerful. This is the way a lot of irreligious spirituality tends to view God. He's with me. He's here. I can feel him at all times. He's for me. Of course, he likes me. Why wouldn't he? There's no such thing as sin. There's no such thing as judgment. Those are kind of like outdated traditional terms. And so he's here. He's for me. He's with me. But there's no vision of God's majesty. There's no vision of Jesus' glory. So the message that he loves me, it's kind of waters off the camel's back. Hey, okay, sure, Jesus loves me. But the really big things in my life, Jesus doesn't have much to do with. Like, he's not as powerful as my friends or my boss or my work or, you know, anything in my life seems more majestic than Jesus because I've never really beheld the glory of Jesus. Because in order to do that, I'd have to see my own sin. I'd have to see how far short I fall, and I never want to do that. And so your friends with you, your friend's for you, he's on your team, but he's not a Navy SEAL. He's kind of like first grade karate level skills. That's nice. Like it's nice to have a cheerleader, but they can't help you with any of the threats that you're facing in your life. So imagine, okay, Jesus is for you and he's powerful. But what if he's not with you? This is the way kind of intellectual, you know, dead orthodoxy type thing tends to view God. Okay, doctrinally, I know God's more powerful than everything else because he's omnipotent, and that means he's powerful. And he's for me because Jesus died in my place and gave me his righteousness, so I know God is for me. But again, if my friend the Navy SEAL is on the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast, it doesn't matter how powerful he is. He's not there. He can't help me. And if you think of God as this distant set of beliefs who's not actually with you, you'll never go to him in your time of need. You won't receive help because you don't have anyone there to help you. When we face threats, when you see things in your life that scare you, when you see something powerful that you can't control, this false interpretation is going to come in. And it's going to say, you're alone. The only things here are you and the threats. It's going to say, Jesus is against you. He's not for you. He wouldn't let you be suffering these things if he was for you. Or it's going to say, these threats, that's the most powerful thing out there. Jesus can't help you with this. He's not powerful enough to overcome the majesty of your friend's opinion, of your future, of the money that you might be losing. Jesus is not powerful enough to address any of those things. And what Jesus is showing us in this passage is that all three of those things are false. He's with you. He's in the boat, and he's with you even to the point of death. There's nothing that he's not with you in. He's for you. He's for you so much that he laid down his own life in order to love you. He's taken God's judgment in your place so you can know he's for you, even when you fall short, even when you fail, even when you offer to him crappy prayers. He's for you. And he's shown you that he's more powerful than anything else, that even wind and sea, I mean, talk about something nobody can control. I was thinking about, we had that snowstorm, you know, a couple weeks ago, and it was interesting to me. It struck me that just as much snow fell in Kensington as in Rittenhouse Square. For all the resources, for all the additional money and power that is in Rittenhouse, they got just as much snow as they did in Kensington. You can't control the threats in your life. You're not in control. But Jesus is. He's the one who can say, be still, be calm to the seas, and they actually listen to him. So when you see those threats in your life, the temptation is going to be to run from Jesus, to think there's safety somewhere other than him. But at the cross, he is with you in death. He is for you, dying in your place. And he is more powerful than anything else because he's conquered not just the waters in the sea. He's conquered the waters of God's judgment for you so that you could have this freedom of knowing him and staying in the boat with him. There is no safer place to be than with Jesus, who is these things for you.